skin of the mission of the rabbi and the organizers and yourselves. Last week we looked at the question of tshuva from a background perspective. We tried to look at some of the mechanisms, if you like, behind the theme of tshuva and how it connects with Rosh Hashanah and the mitzvah of shofar and the depth of understanding of what's called rotzon, or the point of will or freedom or volition in the mind. Since we are just before Yom Kippur now, let's try to look this evening at the more practical level, and perhaps a little bit of the mechanisms as well, but let's try to emphasize the practical stages that the mitzvah of tshuva incorporates. So let's at least try to walk out of here knowing in practice how to put this mitzvah into effect. You know that the mitzvah involves very few and very simple steps. Essentially, tshuva is comprised of three stages: past, present, and future. That's vidui in the present, speaking out or confessing what it is that was done that was negative, regret for the past, and acceptance for the future not to do it again. And the mystery here, of course, is how that simple formula could affect the major changes that it does in the neshama, in the spiritual worlds. And last week we looked at some of the one or two of the facets of those mechanisms. One of the mysteries of tshuva is that it does not only uproot the past, but has the potential to change the past. It could reverse the past, or reverse the polarity, if you like, of the spiritual energy. Let's just look at that for a moment, and then we'll perhaps spend the bulk of the time looking at the practicality. It's well known that, and the classic source for this, the classic discussion of this in the recent past, Rav Elchanan's famous Maamar al Tshuva, in which he discusses the idea of the Chafetz Chaim with regard to a particular question that he asked, and his own idea, other answers being proposed as well. But the theme there is the question of erasing the past, and also of certain components, at least of the past, that are converted. To put it bluntly, tshuva done correctly, mitzvahs can become zchuyos. In some places even says averus. Averus done in the past can become zchuyos, merits, and perhaps even mitzvahs, using that word very broadly. How does this work, and what is the spiritual accounting behind it? Let's take a brief look at that. You know that tshuva done correctly, tshuva done, the basic mitzvah of tshuva, tshuva meyira, which means tshuva done out of fear of punishment, but not out of a deep sense of the understanding of what actually was done. Tshuva meyira erases the past. Tshuva mi'ava converts those things that are negative into, as it were, merits. That needs explanation. First of all, how does that happen? And secondly, what is the difference between those two? And what's the spiritual accounting that lies behind this whole theme? Again, without getting into the complexity that Rav Elchanan discusses over there, because there are two components to mitzvahs and averus, needs full analysis. What we're going to say now looks only at one particular dimension of the issue, but it's a very useful dimension and explains many things. Tshuva meyira means that I regret what I've done, not because I intrinsically regret the thing, but because I have fear, I'm afraid I may be punished. The mechanism, what that achieves is that it eradicates the past and leaves me where I was before I did the thing wrong. If you wish to make a graph, right? If this is a baseline, here's a person moving along at a certain level of spirituality, let's say, if you could measure such things. And this person, at a particular point, they do something wrong. And the error is committed. You could graph that, you could depict that graphically as a person falling. They've been damaged, there's a spiritual scar, there's some spiritual damage. The person now moves along at a lower level. Tshuva returns the person to where they were before. Because tshuva eliminates the error, the sin, and its effect. But tshuva mi'ava leaves a person better than they were before. If you would graph that, you'd see a person moving along at this level. They would maybe do something wrong. Tshuva mi'ava, which is a whole different story, does not return them to where they were before. It makes them, so to speak, a better person than they were before they fell. What is the mechanism there? The mechanism is like this. And a fascinating application of this outside the world of tshuva as well, which is a beautiful demonstration of the arithmetic or the scientific nature, or if you like, or whatever the words are, the precision of the counterpoint and the balance that is set up in the conservation of energy, if you like, in the spiritual world. The mechanism is this, that if a person has a certain problem, and that problem manifests itself in an avera, in their drop, tshuva eliminates that, they go back to where they were before. But tshuva mi'ava has a whole different understanding. Tshuva mi'ava means like this, that I regret having done the thing, not because I'm afraid, which means I don't only gain now the self-control not to do it again, but I think we last week we illustrated it like this, to say that if a child does something for which they are later punished, if they don't do it the next time because they're afraid of being punished, so then what they've achieved is a change in self-control. It's a different child, there's no question. But there's no change in the core. Because, and the proof is very simple. If the child could be assured that they would get away with it without being punished, they would do it again. The proof is, now that's the proof. Do I still wish to do that thing that I did before, only I'm too afraid, which is itself a significant change. But in the core, that means I don't regret the thing itself. Chofetz Chaim even goes so far as to say that that's not really within the what we call Toha al-Rishonis. That person doesn't really regret the past. He only regrets the potential future, the punishment. But a person who does Tshuva Mi'ava regrets the thing itself. That means, in a very deep sense, this is a different person. And the reason this is a different person, as we tried to explain, discuss at length last week, is because a real change in the personality is represented by a change in will. When the volition, or the will, what I want in life, is different, that's the crucial definition of what I am. If I change what I want, that's the only place I can make a real change in myself, beginning with a core. So the mechanism becomes like this. Imagine someone moving along at this level. This person has never fallen, because they've never been presented with a temptation which led them to crash. But this person, although they're holding at this level, above the lower level that is represented by the fall, this person has a problem. This person has a flaw in their character, right? Which, when stressed by the temptation of an nisayon, an ordeal, will cause them to... They don't know about it yet. In fact, that's their real problem. They don't know they have this. There's a hairline crack in their axle. Right? You know, you people who live in this area, I've noticed that most of you drive these big four-wheel drive monsters that you no doubt need to get downtown to your place of work, presumably. You need those things. Those enormous monsters, if you drive one of those things out because you're taking a trip through Death Valley, and as you go out over the curb, your axle breaks. There was a crack in that axle, which the stress broke. Right? You're very glad that it broke then, because when they've welded that thing back together, so then when you're traveling through Death Valley, it will, when your life depends on it, will see you through. There was an undetected crack, which the stress brought out, right? And it caused sometimes it's possible to look at a person's x-ray. I've had the experience of looking at an x-ray and saying to the person, you broke your leg 10 years ago. The person says, how do you know that? And the reason you know, as any doctor will tell you, is that a fractured bone calluses up thicker where the fracture was than it was before. And it'll never break there again. You know, a bone always breaks at its weakest point, logically. After the fracture, there's a callus in the bone, it thickens there, and it won't break there again, it'll break some other place. And you can tell that a previous fracture occurred because where it knits, it is tougher and thicker than it was before. There was a crack which was undetected, the stress brought it out, and it can thereby be fixed. This individual was coasting along, thinking that he had no problem, in fact had a crack in his axle, and when he hit the difficulty, the curve of a nisayon, of an ordeal in life, that thing snapped, and he became broke. Tshuva means that he knit the thing back together. But by definition, tshuva mi'ava means that it's knit to the point where it won't break again. The Rambam says the definition of a Baal Tshuva Gemurah, says the Rambam in the second parak of Hilchos Tshuva, says the Rambam, the definition of Tshuva, Mahi Tshuva Gemurah, says the Rambam, what's a Baal Tshuva Gemurah, says the Rambam, somebody who, when faced with the same situation again, in which he once fell before, the identical situation, this time wouldn't. The Rambam is very exacting in his language. Not only does he say it, he gives a tangible example and he spells it out to an impossible degree of precision. He says, imagine a man who sinned with a woman. And then he does tshuva. And then he finds himself in exactly the same situation, says, the same woman, the same place, He feels the same way about it that he felt before. The Rambam spells it out, makes it obvious that it could never happen. Because it could never be exactly the same issue as it was before. It could be similar, but not exactly the same. What the Rambam means to say is that the definition of a Baal Tshuva is somebody who faces the identical situation that they faced before, and this time they overcome the situation because of the work of Tshuva. Says the Rambam, not because they're too old, not because if a person sinned once before, and a long time later, they managed to resist the sin. Right? And it turns out that the real reason they resisted it was, you know, the arthritis was too serious to chase whatever it was that they chased before. You know, breathlessness overcame them, you know, before they could get close to the scene of the crime. That is not the first class tshuva, says Rambam. And he quotes a possibility, which is Schores Borecha V'Yom. You should remember your creator when you're young, when you can. So it makes it clear that if a person does tshuva, that means the work is done sincerely, and not because of weakness or because of circumstance, but intrinsically the thing is uprooted and eradicated. And the only definition, the only working definition of that, is to be in exactly the same situation that you were once before, and this time through the work that's been done, not do it again. In his being so exacting, the Rambam says two things. First of all, that's the perfect measure. And second of all, it's forbidden ever to be in that situation again. He makes it abundantly clear that a person who goes into such a situation and is victorious has failed. We'll have to discuss that too. Because entering the zone of temptation, right, is real crime. But what he means is, we'll have to discuss that too, but what he means is that the measure of tshuva is that when the thing has been eradicated intrinsically, and the definition, the measure of that is that it wouldn't happen again, that's called tshuva gemura. So look at how we would graph that. If you want to put that into a pictorial representation, you would say that this person at this level does not have the scar or the damage of the avera, but they have the problem. That the character weakness that will lead them to this problem when the time comes. The definition of tshuva gemura, which they've done before, means by definition that they wouldn't do the same thing again. That means that the weakness has been eradicated. They're higher than they were before. Here was a person who had never fallen. In that regard, this person is better than a Baal Tshuva. You know, the famous debate in the Talmud, the Rambam brings it down. Who stands on a higher plane? The Baal Tshuva who has fallen and corrected it? Or a person who's remained pure, never... Obviously, a person who's remained pure, never fallen is higher. But there's a particular dimension in which a Baal Tshuva is even higher. And the Rambam rules that, brings that as a halakhic ruling. Why? Because the person who's fallen is a person who had a flaw in their character. The fall has been used to bring that out and reveal it, and they use that opportunity now to eradicate the problem. So the process has led them to a situation where they don't have, of course, there's one better than that. Of course, what's better than that is detecting the flaw in your character before you fall and welding it together. But that's ideal, right? Yes, it's a pity that it had to come about and reveal itself through that crash. But now that it revealed itself through the crash, that revealed the problem, the person now uses that experience of fall in order to weld together and eliminate the problem. They are now, by definition, through having fallen, they become a person who no longer has that problem. The mechanism is now, you have to understand, beautiful thing to understand, the fall has become an intrinsic and inalienable part of their rise. Kina falti kanti, that's the depth of it. I have risen because I fell. What do you mean, kina falti kanti? What does that mean? It means that I wasn't up before. It looked like I was up, but there was a damage, there was an instability, which has now been eradicated. Yeah? Kiya shafti b'cheshach. Because I sat in darkness, I'm in the light now. Because I fell. Tzaddik has to fall 7 times before he's genuinely up. So what's happened is the Avera, a person who looks back on such an occasion, will relish the moment that he fell. Now, retroactively. He wouldn't give it up for anything. Because that was the experience that became part and parcel, as it were, of his growth. Right? And therefore, that's one understanding, a deep understanding of what it means that the Avera has become a schus. How does an Avera become a schus? The Avera has now become an essential part of this elevation. So it's involved, there would have been better not to do it. It would have been better to eliminate the problem in character, which is what the Neshama is. The Neshama in the next world isn't mitzvahs and Avera. The Neshama is its own intrinsic material. But that material is weak and flawed, or healthy and whole. So this mechanism is what revealed the problem, and yeah, so far so good, right? Are we together? There's a beautiful application of this, which is fantastic to understand, and that is, what happens when you reverse the picture? What happens when a person does mitzvahs and later regrets them? Now, you well know That is one department here, which I don't intend to discuss now, in which regretting mitzvahs in the past is not the same as regretting averus. That's the famous question that Rabbi Chanan asked the Chavetz Chaim, and I think in this very forum you've studied that question before. It's a classic source, so you should then look it up. But in the dimension where they do compare, there's a wonderful application of this. What happens to a person who has done mitzvahs in the past and then regrets them? In certain departments, the person who regrets a mitzvah has not fallen to where they were before they did the mitzvah. They're worse than they were before they ever did the mitzvah. And paradoxically and strangely, the judgment that comes out of this is that that person should not have done those mitzvahs. They weren't ready. Let's get it clear. Here's a person who's moving along at a certain level, never done a mitzvah, particular mitzvah. Opportunity comes their way to do the mitzvah, stresses them in the soil, they rise to the occasion. Person's a better person than they were before. There's the accrual here of spiritual benefit. This person's been uplifted. They now move along at a higher level than they were before. What happens sometime later when they have occasion to regret what they did? So regret, parallel to tshuva mihira, would drop them to where they were before. But genuine regret, definition, that if they were ever put in that situation again, this time they would not do the mitzvah. Yes? Counterpoise too. Then they wouldn't be where they were before. They'd be worse. Huh? Example. Here's a person who is sitting in their home, a certain amount of money, right? Which they are not going to give away. Person arrives with an emergency need. This person rises to the occasion, they give their money. Tremendous benefit. They overcame their own selfishness, they gave away. What happens when a few minutes later someone runs in and says, I have the most amazing investment for you. If you have X, Y, Z amount of money, you'll be rich forever. And the person starts saying, I wish I'd never done that mitzvah. If it ever comes my way, I'll never do it again. So if they regret it sincerely, to the point, according to Rambam's definition, that if they had the chance to do it again, they would not do it, they're a worse person than they were before. Why? Because here, this person, although they've never done the mitzvah, they had the capacity. They had that degree of inspiration. Were they faced with such an opportunity, they would do it. But the process has led them to a situation where, having risen to that occasion and not regretted it, they would not do that thing again. This was a fatal error, this mitzvah. Do you understand what would the application be? Particularly in the field of emunah. Give an example. Example. What should be the assessment? Here's a practical, tangible example in an area that's very hard to calculate otherwise. What is with the person who's deciding to take a step in emunah? Step in emunah. Here's a person, for example, runs a business 8 hours a day. They're challenged to work less and learn more. Wasn't it Rosh Hashanah? My earnings are fixed for the year. If I work 6 hours a day or 4 hours a day, I'm not going to earn any less. After all, ishtadlus is only a tax. No one tries to maximize their taxes. You try to minimize. So let me work less and learn more. How much should a person stick their neck out in emunah? Is that the right thing to do? How much ishtadlus is necessary? The age-old question of ishtadlus and bitachon. How do you assess that? How do you work out? You can't ask a shayla about that. Right, avenue is closed. If you ever go and ask a shayla about emunah, you'll be told the maximum ishtadlus and the minimum emunah. Because emunah you can't ask, you have to be it. If you go ask your rebbe if you close your business half day, any sensible rebbe is going to tell you no. Because if you have to ask already, you're not ready. Emunah is the thing that you have to know Hashem's going to take care of you. You have to know, you have to feel it and know it and have no doubt. As soon as you have to ask somebody else, you're out of the parsha. And therefore, where can you turn? So you have to look within yourself. How do you assess whether you're ready to do such a thing? There's a wonderful calculation. Ask yourself, what will happen, let's say I decide I close my business 8 hours a day and I'll work 4 hours a day, and I'll sit and learn. What would happen if at the end of the month, or the end of the year, I earn half what I earned before and I don't have enough to live on? What will I say? If I will say to myself, it's got nothing to do with ishtadlus, Hashem provides, he's testing me, and I go right on doing it with total emunah, obviously that was the right amount of reduction of ishtadlus that the person should have done. But if this person's response will be, I was a fool to work less. You don't work, you don't earn. There's no one there taking care of me, etc., etc. That person stuck their neck out in emunah to a dangerous level. They shouldn't have done that. The calculation is beautiful. When you decide how much to reduce the effort you make, how many locks you'll put on your door, right? How much ishtadlus you'll make to earn a living, how much effort you'll make to find the right marriage partner. Whatever it is, each of these has different Torah measures. It also needs to be discussed more sensitively. But in general, the answer is, make that amount of effort that if it goes wrong, you won't regret it. More than that is dangerous. I once heard a wonderful example of this. I happened to talking to the Rosh Kollel in a famous yeshiva in the Negev. It was a very well-known Rosh Yeshiva. And he told me an amazing incident that occurred. Shows you how the Torah mind works, often contrary to what you might think. There was a situation once in that yeshiva a number of years, or many years ago, where there were some young Sephardi boys from a certain development town in the area, from very depressed socioeconomic background, young men with very few opportunities, and they were learning in the yeshiva. A group of them came to the Rosh Yeshiva, this is what the Rosh Kollel told me. They came to the Rosh Yeshiva when they were 18 years old, and they said to him, "We have now an ordeal. Most fellows our age are now going out to get jobs, apprenticeships to learn trades, etc. We want your advice. If you tell us to stay and learn another 4 years, we'll learn 4 more years in yeshiva, and we'll do it." You're talking about tmimus, boys with a certain naive purity, even in a very positive sense. We'll stay and learn. If you tell us to go and get jobs, you're our rabbi, whatever you tell us, we'll do. He said to them, "Leave now. Leave now, go and get jobs, learn a trade, that's what you'll do." Now, can you imagine, here young boys come, boys who are in learning, they're going to go out into the difficult world of and then ask you sincerely, you could learn. So the Rosh Kollel, after the incident, he said to the Rosh Yeshiva, "Why don't you tell him that? Here, you turn boys away from yeshiva for..." He said, "Look, what will happen if these young men stay and learn for 4 more years? And they learn sincerely and they grow and they develop. 4 years later, they go out to look for jobs. And they find that it's difficult. They're competing in a world where the other fellows started young and they can't get jobs. They may regret the learning that they did. And if they do, they wipe it out. So what did they gain? I should keep them here for 4 more years doing something which I've induced them into a situation that they're going to regret. And they might end up worse. Now's the time to leave." It's a remarkable thing. This is the counterbalanced situation of this calculation. It's a very very useful, tangible. Rav Miller, that's all from Gateshead, used to teach his Talmidim, boys and girls, that this is the one tangible measure, if you like, rule of thumb, that you can use to assess how much Hishtadlus to make. It's a very useful test. Let's look now, with your permission, at the mitzvah itself. Let's look at the details of tshuva and see if we can work through them and try to point out exactly the technicalities that we need for the next few days. First of all, let's divide this mitzvah into as broad a spectrum as possible, right? As broad brush strokes as possible. We do it like this. There's one category that we'll put up on that side of our blackboard, which the Rambam discusses in the 7th parak of Hilchos Tshuva, which we're not going to discuss this evening, and that is the kind of tshuva a person should do before death. That is not the specific tshuva for a particular action or a particular area of my own inner problems. That is the tshuva, the vidui and tshuva that a person should do before dying. And the Gemara talks about it, the Mishnah talks about it. The obvious question is, how do you know when you're going to die? So you do it. The Mishnah says you do this every day. You do this every day. This is a special form of tshuva. It has an overlap with the mitzvah that we'll discuss. And it is not a regret for particular actions that have been undertaken or done wrongly. This is a tshuva for the misuse of a life opportunity. In other words, this is not because I did this act that needs to be eradicated from the world. This is because I was given a life opportunity, a mind, a body, circumstances, tools. And not only did I not maximize their use, but I failed. Yeah, I did damage as well. Failed to use them to the full extent and use them in disloyalty to the cause. That requires a special kind of tshuva, which is not the particular tshuva for particular details. It's a particular, and it has its own... If you wonder why the Rambam discusses tshuva in detail in the 7th chapter, he starts discussing it all over again. You look carefully, you'll see this is a particular subject. Let's leave that aside for now. And let's look at the rest of the spectrum of the mitzvah of tshuva. To make it absolutely clear, there are 5 possible divisions to the mitzvah. 3 basics, right? 3 basic elements to the mitzvah that always must be done. And in certain circumstances, 2 precursor or prior steps that need to be done before you can do the 3. The 3 steps that are always required, are past, present, and future, as we said, vidui dvarim, like the Rambam says, confession in words, regret and shame for the past, and taking on never to do it again. The other 2 are required only when the victim, when the crime has a victim other than one's relationship with Hashem. In other words, what we call ben adam l'chaveroi, when there's a interpersonal damage. Not, and incidentally, this does not mean a crime that takes 2. Now that's a mistake. Male-female issues in the sensual area, for example, are not interpersonal averis. That's between Adam and Lamakot. The fact that there's an accomplice or a victim is not the issue. There may be a victim too. Someone may have been taken advantage of. Someone's feelings may have been hurt. That's another problem. There may be many problems. But the actual particular transgression there, in fact, the Rambam lists that very one in this context. But again, in general, if you're talking not about Ben Adam Lamakli, right, eating unkosher food, not keeping Shabbos, things that are done in private. If you're talking about interpersonal things, like the Rambam says, harming someone physically, financially, cursing them, yeah, speaking against them, one of the averis where there is not only Hashem to be dealt, an accounting has to be given, but also there's a person involved. Before you can do the tshuva that's required, you need first to make up the damage, and second to appease the individual. Right? Those two are often much more difficult than the three. To put it bluntly, until further notice, if you insist on sinning, limit yourself to those areas that are between you and Hashem. That, you know, that leave other people out of it. Because if you harm someone else, to make up the damage and to gain forgiveness and appease a person can be extremely messy. Extremely difficult. In fact, until further notice, try and avoid the area altogether. But that's particularly problematic. Incidentally, while we're on the subject, as a brief aside, strictly speaking, every mitzvah that's between you and Hashem is also between you and everyone else. Rav Chanan points that out. And also, every mitzvah between me and you, obviously, is also an aver against Hashem. Every mitzvah that I do against you offends not only you, every aver, but also goes against the divine command. So there are two. But also, every aver that I do in private, I damage you. Because when I do something in private that's negative, I bring down the entire Knesset Israel, right? That spiritual entity which is the bonded unity of all our neshamas. Just like one part of the body being damaged, the whole body to some extent suffers. Therefore, when I do something in private, you have a claim against me. And when I bring down my level, so I bring us all down. Lech rei kishicheis amcha. You go down because your people have sinned. Why should Moshe Rabbeinu go down? Because they sinned. Because he's the head of a body. When you step down a step with your feet, your head goes down too. Right? That's incidentally one reason why some of us suffer when others do. One of the reasons why when a destroyer is released, he doesn't discern between deserving and undeserving. One reason. And that reason is that we're an organic entity. We're one being, really. Right? We don't see that always, unfortunately. That's a big problem. But that's who we are. The Arizal says, the last thought you should have before beginning a Shemona Esrei is Avas Yisrael. What's the last thought I should have before I start speaking to Hashem? I think about Hashem. Says, no. The last thought you should have before you enter Shemona Esrei, think about Avas Yisrael. Because that's who you are. That's where your spiritual entity is bonded in, locked into that super rational, that body which transcends the individual. So when I do something against Hashem, I'm also doing something against you. Nevertheless, there's use in dividing these two categories. And furthermore, it's important to know, and this is often misunderstood, there's a particular, again, the division of mitzvahs or averus into Ben Adam L'Chaverim and Adam L'Makrim, people think is a sort of a technical division. Some things happen to have a human victim and some things don't. There's a difference in nature to these mitzvahs. It's important to understand. The difference in nature is this, that when I harm someone else or when I do a mitzvah that benefits you, either way, there's someone involved. The focus of the mitzvah is the person. It's wrong to focus on Hashem in an interpersonal mitzvah. You should only be doing that after there's full accounting for the person. Right? There's something peculiar when you deal with a human being and you're thinking not of them but of Hashem. People think it's very frum to do that. It's a mistake. Right? Can we demonstrate it? Of course. Let's say, I'll give you a very clear demonstration. Let's say you go into an interpersonal mitzvah, Bikur Cholim, for example, someone's sick. So now who's the recipient of the, where is this mitzvah targeted? Where is it posited? So if it's Hashem, you function one way. If it's the person you're going to visit as it should be, you function entirely differently. For example, this person is very frum about the mitzvah, right? All they're thinking about is serving Hashem. So they want to do this mitzvah right. So what are they hoping? That the person is going to be as sick as possible. Of course, sick as possible. Because on the contrary, they're more juicy esrog, right? More mahuda. If they're really suffering and if it's really gruesome, you know, that's a juicy mitzvah, right? And if they'll arrive at the bedside and the person will have gotten better, they'll be thoroughly disappointed because... I once went to visit someone in hospital. Where the person is obviously a person at a certain spiritual level. And the two of us were going up and we walked out onto the floor with the ward. And I made a big effort to go and visit this person. I really did. It took me a long time and I gave up a whole afternoon and I slept. And when we got into the thing, the nurse told us the patient had been discharged. And I said to him, I found myself saying, what a chutzpah, I said. What a chutzpah. Yeah. And I was ashamed of myself because I saw this other person had a genuine rejoicing. But I said, well, in fact, his response was, I get the schar for coming anyway. It's quite true. Of course, he gets the schar anyway. So if you really are selfish, if you really want to do it, you should hope that the person's gotten better. And you get the reward anyway. But we don't function that way. I want to serve Hashem. I want to shake the person like a muhud, like a esrog. That's obviously, the reason there's a difference here in these mitzvahs. The kavon and the mitzvah here is what Hashem wants from you here. Is to relate to the person. Of course, in depth, the reason you relate to that person that way is because that's Salam Alokim. But the thing to grasp here is that the focus of the mitzvah, the focus of Avodas Hashem here, is through the special nature of this person as a person. That's where it is. To see them as transparent is not. It's not the nature of the mitzvah. Each mitzvah has its own tone, its own flavor, and this group of mitzvahs have this particular flavor that the person is the recipient. I once asked a certain Rosh Hashiva, so I once said to him, I'll share with you an issue, I'll share with you a problem. This is not your world, no doubt, but those of us who spend time familiar with the so-called Baal Tshuva world, those people who don't grow up in the religious world, those people who grow up normal, one of the problems they encounter is that moving into a more orthodox, more observant lifestyle is that they feel a very painful denial of spontaneity. Because, it's an important thing to understand, is because when a person is not bound by mitzvahs, so why do you do that which is good? Why do you visit someone who's sick or give up your time, give up yourself? Because there's a tremendous welling up of a spontaneous desire to do that. It's a very uplifting thing. And therefore, this person needs help and you put yourself out and you help. There's an uplift in there. There's a tremendous spontaneous expression of self. But when you do it because it's a mitzvah, there's a danger of feeling not only a lack of spontaneity, but a lack of awe. After all, if you're sick and someone comes to visit you because it's a mitzvah, so you know they're coming because they have to, and you know they know you know that they're only there because they have to, and you know, I mean, you know that they're going to be looking at their watch, and they know you know, and therefore, I mean, where's the feeling? And people who lived a life before where the guiding principle wasn't mitzvahs. It was spontaneous. Of course there's a low side to that. Of course the low side is that you have this welling up of a feeling when it suits you. And you'll do it for those that it suits you to do. And perhaps where someone really needs, they won't get attention. Of course, it's true. But nevertheless, and it's quite true, there is a tremendous depth of emotion and of welling up of self-expression in a spontaneous, in an enem mitzvah voice. What is the solution here? The solution here is that to understand that the purpose of mitzvahs, when you do a mitzvah, is a mitzvah, right? When you go and visit someone who's sick, the Torah ideology here is you should be training yourself to be the person who does that spontaneously, even though it's a mitzvah. That means even if you wouldn't be commanded now, you would be doing that thing. What's that? Yeah, the dynamic here is the energy to train yourself to become that sort of person. Exactly the opposite of doing it because there's a subtle balance here. Because doing it because Hashem commands me. But feeling the human contact in it, that's a great... And you perceive readily with people who have trained themselves in a genuine Torah depth, where it's tangible, you'll see that the love that comes across and the spontaneity that comes across, and the warmth that comes across, is so obvious that it's quite clear that if it wouldn't be obliged, it would be done anyway. This, in fact, is the depth, although that's not our subject directly, this, in fact, is a depth between Eino Mitzvah Oeseh and Mitzvah Oeseh. Why the Gemara says an Eino Mitzvah Oeseh, somebody who's not commanded and does is greater. It's a long discussion, but just a brief insight into it. Someone who's not commanded and does, it's true they have a welling up of spontaneous self-expression. But the maximum they could ever express is only themselves. That means when I do something because I really want to, and I put my entirety into it, so it may be fantastic and wonderful and deep, but it can never be more than me. But when I do something because an infinite source commands me, I lock in. I become the cutting edge of something that begins in infinity. When Chazal said Gadol Hamutzuva Oese, they didn't mean a little bit bigger. They meant infinitely bigger. Because when I am not Mitzvah and I do, so the Tzivui comes from here, from my Ratzin. It begins here and it expresses me, at best. But when I do, because the ultimate Ratzin commands it, and I say Ratzin Charitzinoi, and I lock into that partnership, where it comes from the ultimate source, and I'm the legs that it walks on, as it were. You know, the Sfas Emes says, before Yom Kippur, it's allowed to just dwell on this just for a moment. The Sfas Emes says that when you do a Mitzvah, you lock into an infinite. Amazing idea. You know what a mitzvah is? You know the word mitzvah? Do you mind if we digress just for a moment? I'm not going to get fired, am I? The word mitzvah, people think, means commandment. It's not the correct Hebrew construction. The word tzivui is a commandment. Mitzvah has a different nuance. It also means a commandment. But its root means to be together. But tzavta chada means in one bond. The Hebrew word tzevet means a crew, where different elements function together in unison. A mitzvah means that the one who commands and the one who is commanded have bonded into a crew or a unit where they work in unison and become one. That's what it means. The depth of it, says the Sfas Emes, if one would really understand this idea, one would never be the same, is that the way a mitzvah works is in a completely ineffable source, completely beyond our understanding, a desire is formulated. The Ratzon Hashem, that this thing be done. What is the reason for a Ratzon? We said last week, you can't ask that question. It comes from beyond any understanding. Ultimate source, the Ratzon Hashem. And it comes down, as it were, in the divine system, without going into what that means, and it gets formulated as an instruction, do thus, a mitzvah. And then it stops, and the thing is not done. And then the human being is required to step in. And the human being hears the command, generates the mechanism that's necessary, and goes and does it. So that on the ground, it happens. And a circuit is closed. In an infinite source, a desire originates, and down on the ground, it gets done. How does this original desire manifest in an action? Hashem is the original desire, and the human being is the action. How does the human being do this? Because by stepping into the breach, as it were, when I enter that zone where the mitzvah stops, it becomes a commandment but not yet fulfilled, what do? I have to step in and make my rotzon parallel to his. I say Ritzon Charitzonoi. I have to negate my Ratzon to be someplace else, conquer that ego, step in, and make my desire what his is. This is what Tzelem Elokim means. You step in here, make yourself exactly want what he wants, but then, unlike him, he who commands and brings it down to a formulation of a command and stops, you take this as a command, will it because he wills it, align your desire with his, and then carry it out. At that moment, you and Hashem fuse into one organic entity in which you become an essential component of his Ratzon being done. At that moment, you swell to infinite proportion. Because at that moment, you become part of an infinite. Yet your desire originates now not in you. You've negated that, made it transparent. It originates in infinity. And you are the cutting edge that makes it happen. In that moment, when you negate your own ego and step into this thing that you might not have wished to do originally, you become real. Because Hashem is the definition of reality. So you step into being part of a circuit that's defined, that defines reality. In that moment, by negating your individuality, by negating your own ego, by giving it up, you become real. You not only you become the most self-expressed reality. The paradox is in losing yourself that way. That's exactly where you discover yourself. Says what happens when you spend half an hour doing an avera? Don't tell me what to do. I want to stand here. What happens? What happens is that circuit is not closed. The Ratzon is formulated, comes down as a mitzvah, and there's an empty gap in reality. You stand in that moment in time feeling amazing. Because now in yourself, you represent in a false way all of reality. Who tells me to do this thing? Me! This doesn't come from someplace else. There's no negation of ego. I formulate it in and of myself. The Yetzirah here is a divine one. You have to understand this. The Yetzirah, the negativity here, not the sensual negativity that brings you down. This is the negativity of COVID. This is the negativity. This is the Yetzer, the divine Yetzer. Yet what moves me here is the feeling that I'm divine. I formulate my own desires. But in that moment when I formulate my own desire and carry it out, I've moved out of reality. I've disappeared. But not only that, reality hasn't been fulfilled. So that the whole thing crashes. In the next world, when a person's exposed to that, the half an hour that you spent doing a mitzvah, what you the tangible representation of that is an electric sense of reality. the half an hour that you spent doing an Avera is sensed in the next world as total non-reality, of just not being there. And you're accountable for that. Not only for the moving aside, but for not having built what should have been built at that moment. That's the mechanism of Mitzvah Voice. These are the two categories. Let's go back to our practicalities and see if we can learn the details. Let's start with Mitzvahs Ben Adam Lamakim, where there's no human beings involved, making it complicated. There are three elements that are needed. These three elements are all that are required. The Rambam says you do these three, the thing is expiated and annihilated immediately. Strictly speaking, that's only Mitzvah's essay, again, without going into too much detail. A positive mitzvah that was not fulfilled. The omission of positive commands is always much more lenient than the commission of negative commands. So the omission of positive command, right, a person didn't put on tefillin or didn't say Shema, not putting on tefillin happens to be particularly serious. I think we discussed that last week in one particular way. And it's very much connected to what we just discussed. This connection at this point of origin with that which is beyond. Think about it, you see the depth. But a positive mitzvah that's negated, not talking here when we have a Beis HaMikdash, which is completely different, there's a completely different level there of kapara and atonement. It's the intense lack that we feel at this time. But a mitzvah that's omitted, and tshuva is done, says the Rambam, Eino zaz misham. That means in English you'd say, on the spot. That's the English idiom. Forgiven on the spot. Before you could move, as it were. Except for two mitzvahs, essay, namely, failure to have a bris, circumcision, and Korban Pesach, which we don't have today. Those are two exceptions. But apart from that, forgiven immediately. Second is mitzvahs, loisa se, transgression of negative commands, says the Rambam. You need to do tshuva, and it hangs in the balance until you survive through a Yom Kippur. Even if on Yom Kippur you're not doing tshuva, even if you're unconscious. But it's sumo shel yom. The day itself brings home the tshuva, the two melt into one, and the atonement is achieved. Things that are more serious, for example, negative commands that have death sentences, or chorus, those things need tshuva, which hangs in the balance, survive through Yom Kippur, and you need also yesurim. Certain degree of suffering, whatever the degree is, brings home those two other elements, and tshuva is effective. And there's one category which is more serious than all of those, which requires all three elements and the transition from this world to the next. That means tshuva doesn't really cleanse the neshama, it hangs in the balance, and only when a person dies is it brought home. There's only one avera in the book like that, and that is chilul Hashem. You know, that's a chilul Hashem, desecration of Hashem's name. That requires death to expiate. What is a chilul Hashem? You do something a little sharp, let's say, in business. And they say his name's Goldberg. You identified as Jewish, and you did something that's perceived to be problematic, dishonest. It's chilul Hashem. And, say, the sources, it goes in proportion to your Jewish profile. The more Jewish your name, your appearance, the more you're observant, the more you represent Judaism, the more culpable you are. That's chilul Hashem. Rabbi Yehuda says that there's one hope you have other than dying. Not that you have to die sooner than otherwise, just that that moment affects it. But Rabbi Yehuda says you can't seek to counterbalance this with a serious dose of Kiddush Hashem. Kiddush Hashem. You do something scrupulously honest in business and they say his name's Goldberg. That is a tremendous... My sister went to a supermarket in Johannesburg. And when she came home, she found that they gave her two deodorants, and on the slip she saw she only charged for one. So my sister, being a very good girl, I mean, I taught her everything that she knows, she went back the next day, and she said to the cashier behind the counter, she said, look, I got home yesterday, and you gave me this, I hadn't paid, and I've come back to return the... The Portuguese lady behind the counter called together all the cashiers in the supermarket and the manager, and they told my sister that in 25 years of running that store, no one had ever come back to return an item, right? And my sister said to them, she said, look, I had to do it, I'm Jewish. Ooh. That's what you call Kiddush Hashem. In fact, it's worth stealing a deodorant. The point is that, given that hierarchy of requirements, nevertheless, the tshuva is required. What are the three components? So Rambam says like this, and it's worth blazing into one's memory. He phrases it in one sentence, the Rambam, which covers all the requirements. If you consider yourself a black belt, then you will not use this formulation of the Rambam's. You look up Shari Tshuva, there he has 17 requirements. But these are the three essentials. Rambam says like this, you say, Ana Hashem, which is addressing Hashem in an expression of longing, Chatasi, Ovisi, Pashati Lafanecha, I have sinned in front of you with three words denoting what is not really accurately translatable in English, but three levels of unintentional, deliberate, that means even though I knew it was wrong, and thirdly, because it was wrong, rebellious. Rambam says there's at least some of each of those in every Avera, some of each of those. That is what you are saying, Lifanecha, in front of you, right? Which acknowledges exactly where the offense is placed. That's the preamble. And then you say, Vasisi kach v'kach, dotted line, you fill in your own words, whatever you did. And then you say, that's vidui, what the Rambam calls vidui dvorim, confession in words. And then you say, Hare nichamti uboishti b'maasai, I regret what I've done and I feel shame, puts both those elements in, that's regret for the past. And thirdly you say, v'l'oilam eini chayze l'davaz, I'll never do this thing again. Right? Three elements, I think we mentioned them already last week, three basic requirements, one sentence, that is the mitzvah tshuva. The easy part, of course, is the words. The hard part we discussed already is the fact that it has to be meant and that a rotzon is changed. Let's look halachically at these three elements. First of all, vidui, confession. So very briefly, try to sketch here the minimum halachic requirements are as follows. Vidui must be vidui dvarim, right? The Torah says, vizvadu, you shall confess, and the name of the mitzvah in Torah language, in Torah literature, is vidui and vidui dvarim. That means it's a positive mitzvah. It doesn't only expiate and eradicate sins in the past. It itself is a positive mitzvah. Apart from the merits that accrue from converting avaris into, this itself is a positive mitzvah. This means it has to be done. Some of Oshim say that if you don't do it now, in Aseret Yemei Teshuva and Yom Kippur, it's an extra avera, because when the opportunity is specially presented and you scorn it, there's a special degree there of culpability, more reprehensible. But this is what it is, vidui dvarim. And the halachas are like this. First of all, it must be spoken, not thought. The mouth must formulate the words loud enough for oneself to hear, like tefillah. Thinking these things does not fulfill the mitzvah. Without getting into too much detail, thinking tshuva does affect tshuva. But it's not fulfill the mitzvah of tshuva in vidui dvarim. Hirhurei tshuva, thoughts of tshuva, are not nothing. Far from it. Again, it's important to know. A person who thinks tshuva, right, decides to move their life onto a whole new track, right, is 100% valid movement of a life. It's machriya a person, it moves a person onto a whole new track. It fulfills entirely the purpose of tshuva in the sense of moving a person into a new... First of all, this is essential to know for people who cannot speak. A person is lying semi-conscious with a ventilator tube in their trachea who cannot speak, right? Who has hirurei tshuva, this is very far from nothing. This is... And secondly, there are clear proofs. One is a classic proof that the Gemara says that if a person marries a woman on condition that he's a tzaddik. A person marries a woman, right? If I say, Arat Mekudeshesli, you are betrothed to me on the condition that I have £1 million in the bank. And if the lady says, yeah, I mean, one would question her sincerity in the first place, but if she says yes, then if the condition exists, she's married. How about if I say, on condition that I'm a righteous individual, when I'm patently, obviously, an evil individual. Says Gemara, the tshuva is valid. Shema hir her tshuva biliboy. Maybe he decided that moment to cleanse himself and... So he didn't say, he didn't do vidui, he didn't say confession. You see clearly that the condition is upheld to the extent of validating a marriage if he only thought tshuva in his heart. You see clearly it's valid. What's the difference with vidui? The difference is this. First of all, of course, that's the mitzvah. But the difference in spiritual accounting terms, if you like, is this. I once spoke to a great Kabbalist in Yerushalayim. He put it for me in very graphic terms. He said, a person who's Mahare and Shuba, a person who decides to become a new person without saying the words of Vidui, is a person who's taken a train that's moving one direction and moved it onto a new track. The train is a new, heading to a new destination. There's no question about that. But the baggage still attached. The responsibility for the past remains attached. That miracle, to detach yesterday's accounts, to detach the coaches from the train, that you need to fulfill the positive mitzvah. So there's a hachra, the person moves on to a new track, but you still have schlepping along. You want to convert the past, eradicate it, elevate it, transform it, etc. For that you need to fulfill the positive mitzvah tshuva. That is a new track plus eradicating the baggage. Yeah, that's the difference. So vidui dvarim must be spoken out and not thought. Secondly, it must be any language that you understand. Any language, it must be understood. Just like saying Shema, the work here is the work of the heart, right? That is the work. Although the mitzvah is to express it, it must be understood. Hebrew is better,
Alpi Kabbalah.
Kabbalistically, it is better to speak Hebrew. The Kabbalistic sources say that one breaks through certain gates that are opened by Lashon Kodesh, which are not opened by other languages, and therefore Hebrew is better. What do you do if your Hebrew is not good enough? If you can't express yourself well enough in Hebrew, and you want the benefit, here's something you can do. You can daven together with a minyan and speak any language. If you start together with a minyan, and then let's say at the end of the Amidah, for example, good place to do it, you then switch into your own personal expression and you use any language, yeah, a minyan opens up certain gates that the individual does not, equivalent to speaking Hebrew. That's incidentally, can you think of a proof that a minyan opens gates that don't require Hebrew? One word proof? One word, you're only allowed one word. Kaddish. Kaddish we say only with a minyan and not in Hebrew. Right? Kabbalistically actually we say Kaddish in Aramaic because Aramaic is the language of the negative, of the dark side, of the negative forces. And so we say Kaddish in their language, we want to knock them out on their own turf. We use their tool to knock them out. Now, that's a deep Kabbalistic idea. But the point is that we say it only with a minyan, and we don't say in Lashon Kodesh. And therefore, you can, and of course this applies to women, if a woman wants to daven with a minyan of men, then she can get together, and when they daven, she can, the Gemara has a story about a woman in the time of the Tanoim, in fact, who was exceedingly old, and she came to one of the Tanoim and asked him why she was still alive. She perceived that perhaps it was already beyond the sell-by date, as they say. And he said to her, what do you do? She said, she goes to a minyan every morning. He said, stop for 3 days. The woman stopped going to the minyan for 3 days and she died immediately thereafter. So you see, no. So she is doubling together with a minyan. When one, a very convenient time to do this, there are a number of opportunities during the Amidah in order to say one's own confession, a very convenient way and easy to get by without halakhic complications of interruptions of the brachas and so forth, is at the very end of the Amidah. You know that what we do is we finish Mona Esrei, which we say in the plural, we then switch into a singular. Did we discuss this on last? We switch into Lakai Netzol Lashoni Mera, which is my own singular expression, and then you sign off again with the Yilaratzen at the end before closing out. You still stand in front of the Shekhinah, but having spoken now in the singular, and then you sign off. There's a very beautiful custom before you sign off to say your own name. Of course, you don't have the effrontery to say your own name as such, but you say the pasuk in Torah, which begins with the same letter that your name begins with, and ends with the same letter that your name ends with, as a beautiful Torah hint to where you are located in Torah, right? And therefore, you quote that pasuk, you quote that verse, that as it were introduces you, and then you are moving into your own free expression. The deep reason for this is also fascinating to know. Do you know why we do this? The reason is because when you want to announce yourself, right, the sensitive Jewish way to do this is, imagine you took 3 steps forward, you're about to address Hashem, and you say your name. You take 3 steps forward and you say, Tats is here. Unfortunately, it's not so clear how much attention that achieves in Shemaim. We don't do that. We say, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. That is what you call very big name dropping. That is, we start off with a mention of those who are guaranteed to gain attention. That's what we do. I call on you as a great-grandchild. That's what we do. And then at the end of the Amidah, you slip yourself in on the coattails of Jewish history by saying your own name. That's our sensitive way of being. So what we do here is we introduce ourselves and then we say our own, and then you can use any language. So that is a beautiful way to do it. So let me just revise. Any language must be spoken out audibly. No one else allowed to hear, with certain exceptions, which is not going to go into now, but no one else is allowed to hear, unlike certain other religious systems who confess to an individual. On the contrary, a sign of real shame and contrition is that you don't want anyone else to hear it, and we are not allowed to have anybody else here. And finally, says the Rambam, the more you say, the better. Harezim Meshubach. The more you say, the better. The reason is not because repetition is good. On the contrary. But because there's a sense of the point here. And that is every Avera offends many levels of the Neshama. And what you try to do here is speak out all of them. Again, when you do something wrong, you're accountable for the action. You're accountable for the time wasted that you should have been doing a mitzvah. You're accountable for the thought of the aver. All our sources indicate that when you do an aver, you're punished more for the thought than for the action. We're talking here classically in a case where the thought led to an action. If the thought is denied and controlled and suppressed, then there's merit in that, right? With certain exceptions, again, is now not the time to go into. But when a thought leads to an action, then there's more punishment for the thought than for the action. The reason for this spiritually, Nevi Shechaim speaks out very clearly, is because an action offends an animal level of the human construction, namely the body. But a thought of an avera offends the level of divine, it means your mind is a tool, much closer, much more vested with Kedusha. And therefore, thoughts that fill the mind, in the classic mashal, a person who offends and behaves in a coarse fashion in the provinces, is much less guilty than someone who offends in the same way in the palace of the king, in the throne room in front of the king. Yeah, there's much more. And therefore, a person who uses the mind for that which is negative, in that sense, it's worse. So there's a problem with that. There's a problem with the pleasure. There's a problem with the desensitization that an avera brings about. If other people saw you, there are so many levels that ripple out from one avera, that a person who is genuinely working on it isn't just saying, I did X, but he speaks out and works through in genuine remorse for all these levels, all the dimensions, and all the layers of the neshama that have been sullied and soiled. And that's why speaking out more, one of the levels, one of the reasons why speaking out more is better. Those are the general areas of bidu. With your permission, I'm going to take a few minutes and run through the basic requirements, and I'll stop for questions if you don't mind. Yes? So remember your questions. If I didn't cover it, I'll be happy to stop, and those who want to stay are welcome to do so. It could very well be that I've left out something important. So that's bidu. Then you have regret for the past. Here you have to express genuine regret and shame. Usually this is not so much of a problem. If one needs motivation, one is allowed to begin with the regret because of the fear of punishment. Again, it's a good place to start. And finally, one must say that I will not do this thing again. This is very problematic for many people, so I'll touch on it briefly. It always causes problems. What does one mean? Ulo olam eini chozer l'davar zeh, I will never do this thing again. Understand this very clearly. To say I won't do it again does not mean a prophetic statement about the future. Because who can say that? Who can say I won't do this thing again in the prophetic sense? Nobody can say that, right? And many people hold themselves back from this element of the vidui, right? Wrongly. What's meant is not I'm predicting that I won't do it again. What's meant is very clearly, the Rambam makes it plain. As I stand here, if I would now be transported back to that fateful moment, because of the work I've done on myself now, as I hold now, I would overcome that situation. If one can clearly say that, that's what one means. What will be next week when you're feeling low and down and you got depressed and something happened and you got schlepped into a place you shouldn't have been and who knows what, you have to handle next week. The critical issue here is this presently sincere? If it's meant sincerely, that means I have conquered and killed this area. It's not part of me anymore. I don't want that thing anymore. Right? I've risen above that. One says this. What happens next week when one does it again is you have to do tshuva again. Right? You know, again, the reason many people found this difficult, because most of us have problem areas that we keep coming back to. It's like married couples. Married couples argue about the same things that they always argued about. This for 35 years, they say the same. You'd think they'd have a little creativity and put in a bit of, you know, but that's not the way it is. They go back to the same issues and they use the same words about them again. That's how we are in our own inner marriage. We tend to have problem areas and we go back. What bothers most people is, how can I do tshuva? After all, I've done it so many times and I keep going back to this area. How can I be sincere when I... This is a problem. What one means is, if one is sincere that I've negated this area, you do tshuva. If it happens again in the future, then you have a problem. You have to do tshuva again. What is definitely not allowed, says the Rambam, and he lists it as a separate avera, is to say that I've conquered this area when you haven't. To say that I won't do it again when you're already thinking of the next time, says the Rambam, is completely invalid tshuva. It's a new avera. You're lying through your teeth. And for that, you have to do tshuva again. In such a situation, one should say, this is what I did. I'm ashamed and sorry. Help me not to do it again. And you put your money where your mouth is, says the Rambam. You skirt that area. You never go close to it. You make strategies not to do it. Right? The real misuse of free will, again, it requires a separate discussion. The ultimate misuse of free will is not to fail in a nisayon. It's to put yourself into the nisayon. Because either you'll fail into what, you'll fall into what they call taiva, into that side, or you'll fall into gaiva. Either you'll succumb, and you'll fall into that, or you'll overcome it and express ego. I managed. So choosing the Avera is always a failure. The Gemara says clearly, a person comes to a fork in a road, where women, one fork takes him past a river, where women are doing some washing, perhaps, and they're immodestly exposed. The other road takes him home. So the man says to himself, well, look, which road shall I take? Am I not in the world to conquer ordeals? Basilis Yesharim says, you're created for three things. La'avoid, la'asos mitzvahs, v'la'amod b'nisayon. La'avoid, to serve, to perform mitzvahs, v'la'amod b'nisayon. Let me take the road where the women are, not look. Says the Gemara, if he takes the road where the women are and does not look, he's called a Rosh, an evil man. Because he failed the test. The test is not whether you look at the women. The test is which road will you take? And this individual not only failed even to identify the test. Right? That is a loss. So a young man said to me some time ago, I've just, back on cocaine. What happened? I knew this young man. He's a very talented young man. Very talented. He was achieving great things. And he eventually got into a habit and eventually, as they put it, as they call it in the drug jargon, he bottomed out. He got to a point where he lost his wife and his family and he was almost died. And at that point, close to death, he managed to get into a rehabilitation program. And 3.5 months later, he was, again in the technical jargon, dry. Came out of the rehabilitation program, got a job, and he rebuilt. He rebuilt everything. A remarkable rise, and he was flying. What happened? 3 weeks ago, I was driving home from work, and I said to myself, I'm just going to go and visit my old dealer, just to sit and face her and prove to myself that I've conquered it. So he went back to see her, and he's back on the drug. The problem is not what happened in front of that dealer. The problem is going back in the first place. It's unforgivable. That's against... Yeah. That's the misuse of free will. It's not choosing wrongly. It's putting yourself into the situation. You note that Adam was not asked to do something. He was asked to not do something. Hashem didn't say, do. Hashem said, acknowledge that I am the Metzius. And Adam Arishan said to Hashem, you mean you want me just to be a passenger? Just to sit here and do nothing? Hashem said, that's exactly what I want. Give yourself to me. Admit that you are nothing and I'm everything, then you become part of me. And he said, but, you gave me this cosmic power, you want me not? And Hashem said, that's what I want. The ultimate Arkada. You know what the Arkada is? Isn't that a peculiar word? What would you have named that incident? Shechting, Ha'alor, raising him, Ha'krova, Korban, Akeda, to time? We always name things for the essence in Torah, always, nothing peripheral ever. The time? The essence is the taking of the life, the spilling of the blood, one of the avoiders, something. Binding? That's the ultimate. Ultimate is the withholding of power of self. It's the locking in and not expressing. That's the ultimate expression of Bukhari. Anyway, that is what's meant by the three stages of not avidu, or speaking it out, regret and remorse for the past, and not doing it again in the future. Let me just point out that when the Rambam says the more you speak, the better, yeah, the more you speak out, the better, there's one exception. And that is a kind of person who on Yom Kippur sits there and begins to recount the detail of the Avera. Before they know it, they're back in a reverie. You know, back in a delicious and very technicolored, three-dimensional reenactment at the scene of the crime. There's very likely to be very little remorse in that type of reconstruction. And in those circumstances, one should mention very generally the area and leave it up to, you know, the details to be filled in and move rapidly on while there's still a modicum of remorse. That is an exception to speaking out the details. But to the extent that one can speak out remorse, that is Sal Shavida. That summarizes the halachas of the three basic elements. Can we spend a few more moments? Yes? Can we spend a few more minutes? Let's just spend a few minutes dealing with halachas very briefly of what happens when you've offended someone else. Incidentally, one important point, is a critically important point, must not be omitted. Do you know that on Yom Kippur, in the Machzor, we never fulfill the third component? Okay, this is absolutely critical. The requirements of tshuva are vidui, regret, and saying you won't do it again. In the whole Machzor, there is plenty of vidui. There's plenty of remorse and regret, but there's no statement, I will not do this again. And if you do not say that, you've not fulfilled the mitzvah. Why was it not put into the liturgy? The reason's obvious. The reason is because we always speak in the plural. We're not going to go now into why that is. We always speak for all of us.
So we can all say collectively we have done all these things. On the contrary, even if I haven't done it, I can say we have. I may not have done this detail or that, but I can say we have. And we can all say sincerely we all regret it, but I can't say you won't do it again. Well, you can't do that in the plural. And you have to know that. And therefore we confess in the plural, and you should do it in the singular as well. And we express remorse in the plural, you should do that in the singular. But if you don't say, I'll not do it again, you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah. There's an allusion to it in the Yehi Ratzon at the end. Yehi Ratzon lefanecha she'loi echet ta'oid. Yehi Ratzon, help me not to. Some say that is the beginning at least of this. But you need to say, I'll move away from this. I won't do it again. Okay, does this feel? Very briefly, this requires much more detailed discussion, but very briefly, the other two components are as follows. When the victim of the avera is someone else, you have two very potentially thorny and messy, very demanding steps that have to be done. The Rambam says there's no hope, tshuva, if you haven't fixed up the problem. If you don't appease the person and make up the damage and you do tshuva, he says it's like going to a mikveh holding the source of contamination in your hand. That's ridiculous. It's not going to be purified that way. You first have to relinquish the problem and then do tshuva. Even after appeasing the person, you still have to do tshuva. You still have to speak to Hashem. But before you speak to him, you have to speak to the person. And it goes like this. First of all, you have to redress the wrong. You have to pay back what you took. Right? And if it wasn't financial, you can pay financially very often. On the contrary, we have five heads of damage in halacha, where you pay financially, even for injuring a person physically, even for causing them shame, even for pain. But the wrong has to be redressed, and if necessary, in financial terms. It does not say anywhere that the person has to know. The person has to know. If you work for someone and certain funds have been misappropriated, you don't have to tell them. Not to fulfill this component. If the money's put back, so that wrong has been redressed. There's no requirement here that the person is told under this heading. Huh? I personally have dealt with cases, remarkable cases, where money had to be given back. Large sums of money. And in case you think it's difficult getting a large sum of money out of somebody, try giving a large sum of money to somebody without telling him why. It's a very suspicious circumstance, and that has to be done, and ways and means can be developed, and if necessary, it has to be done. So the damage has to be redressed. The problems here are when you can't find the person, when they're not alive anymore, when you dealt with many people. One gentleman came and he said to me, for the last 25 years, I've been running a business. Well, wealthy individual, I know the man personally. He's now become very much more motivated, Jewishly knowledgeable. For 25 years, I've been running a big business, and for 25 years, I've been overcharging and undersupplying. I want to pay it back. First of all, the man's not worth what it would cost to pay back 25 years of big business. And secondly, how does he find the people? Jews, non-Jews, alive, not alive. How does he begin to do that? So the first can bring down, the Rambam starts the section by saying that all things can be corrected. That's the good news. Some are more difficult, but all things can be. And the sources bring down specifics. For example, if a person's no longer alive, one can give to the estate or the children where the benefit would have accrued. If that can't be done, then one should divest oneself of the money, make an assessment, even if it's over a period of time, give it to Beis Din, and preferably can be given to a community cause. Because by giving it out to the community, one has divested oneself of the wrong, the problem, and will ripple out back to an effect where it should have been. It's not direct, and it's not perfect, but that is the way. And there are many, many other details brought. So that is with regard to making of the damage. Finally, asking for forgiveness can be an extremely challenging. So I'll mention this briefly and we'll close with that. Asking the person, being mefayes, as the Rambam says, to appease them can be extremely difficult. The reason is, first of all, most of us find great difficulty facing someone and saying, I'm sorry, I was wrong, and just very hard to do. Secondly, sometimes you can't do it because they don't know it happened. Or they don't know it was you. And most of us can't face saying sorry. But when you have to go to a person and say, look, you don't know, but I'm the one who's been sticking this knife in your back for the last who knows how long, when they didn't know, most of us just much too squeamish to do that. And finally, what happens when you know they won't forgive you anyway? What happens in your better judgment? You go, they won't forgive you. They will bear a grudge against you, which is a Torah prohibition. They'll take revenge against you, which is another Torah prohibition. They won't forgive you anyway. What do you do there? You know the halachic difference between taking revenge and bearing a grudge? You have to know the halachic definition of taking revenge is when you go to your neighbor and say, can I please borrow your lawnmower? And he says, no. And he comes up the next week and says, can I please borrow yours? If you say no, that's called revenge. If you go to your neighbor and say, can I please borrow your lawnmower? And he says, no. And he comes over the next week and says, can I please borrow yours? And you say, sure, I'm not like you. That is Issa Doraisa, Torah prohibition of bearing a grudge. You have to keep your mouth shut and give him the... They tell a story about a man who was crawling through the desert, apocryphal story, crawling through the desert, dying of thirst, when another man rode past on a horse, looked down at him, and left him to die. Miraculously, he survived, and some years later, he ended up being the president of a big business corporation. And one day, his office door opened, and a man came in asking for a job. And he recognized the face as the face of the man who left him to die in the desert. Had he refused him the job, it would have been taking revenge. And had he reminded him and given him the job, it would be bearing a grudge. He said nothing and gave the man the job. That's what a Jew is required to do. Of course, if you didn't give him the job for a valid reason, for example, let's say that individual was applying to be a gentle, tender caregiver for frail elderly, you know, then you might judge the man as not suited to the occupation. If you did, that would be justified, right? That's not revenge, is it? So that is, what do you do in such a situation? And we'll finish with this. There are halakhic opinions. Some say this was a famous argument between Rosh Hashanah and the Chafetz Chaim, two different opinions on this matter. But I'll mention it. There is an opinion that you can ask a person forgiveness without telling them what you did. Some poskim don't like it, because how can they genuinely, sincerely forgive you if they don't know what you're talking about? Others say that as long as they mean genuine blanket forgiveness, then it's valid. If you sign a check without filling in a mountain, and I fill the mountain, provided your account has the cover, then the check's valid. So someone says, I forgive you whatever you've done. If they mean it, and that's the problem. Does a person mean that? Or are they mouthing words? But if they mean whatever you've done, as often is a genuine meaning, for example, parents saying to children. Parents says to a child, it's a genuine forgiveness. Sometimes in difficult ex-marital situations, it's very difficult. The pain is often great and it's hard to do. These are problems. But, if a blanket forgiveness is given, it is, if it's meant, it's valid. The Rambam says, incidentally, that when one's asked for forgiveness, it's a specific cruelty to refuse. Right? And on the contrary, if you need forgiveness from someone, says the Rambam, ask them again and again. If they refuse, send a delegation of friends. If that fails, do it again. Fax them, email, whatever it takes. It doesn't say exactly, but you do whatever it takes to importune them to gain their forgiveness. If you do that a required number of times and they still refuse, it's an unusual cruelty on their behalf, becomes their avera, and you're not required to ask anymore. Except if it's your Torah teacher, your Rebbe, then you're required to go back 1,000 times. That's a unique exception, fascinating incident in the Gemara that illustrates it. It's a bit late now to go into detail, but that is a unique exception. Otherwise, there's a certain number of times, then you leave it closed, the person. What happens to an individual that asked for forgiveness and cannot bring themselves to forgive? Here, one needs a little vested interest. Right? Let's say you've been very deeply hurt. Incidentally, you should forgive even if you're not asked. You know, being asked is not relevant. You know that in Tfilah Zakah, which we say before Yom Kippur, the Chofetz Chaim says to bring a head. You know, there's a beautiful part where you voluntarily forgive anyone who has anything on you. The Chofetz Chaim says not to leave it to where it's placed in the Tfilah. You may not get there. Say it right at the beginning, right? You say, Hi Hashem, on this Erev Yom Kippur before Kol Nidre, I hereby forgive anyone who has anything on me. I want no one's accounting on my head this Yom Kippur, right? And whether they deserve it or not, I let it go. And then you say, and in the merit of this effort, put into the hearts of anyone out there who has anything that I am, put into their hearts to forgive me at this point. And therefore, there is a vested interest. When you can't bring yourself to forgive someone, remember one detail of spiritual accounting. The whole din is midah keneged midah. The whole judgment in Shemayim is only measure for measure. That's what it means, your hand writes. That's what it means. The only thing that happens is you are exposed to yourself. There's no courtroom in which people speak, and it's you being exposed to yourself. And all that happens to you is what you have done. And therefore, if you stand in the dock, this Yom Kippur, or whenever it is, and you say, Hashem, forgive me, and you don't deserve to be forgiven, you won't be. You won't be forgiven. How can you, if you ask to be, Rosh Hashanah, you're standing there asking to be forgiven, when you don't deserve it? You're my din. Din means you get what's coming to you. How can you ask for forgiveness when you don't deserve it? What sense does that make? There's one very good sense it makes. If you ask Hashem to forgive you for something that you genuinely do not deserve to be forgiven for, that you once forgave someone for something they did not deserve to be forgiven for, you'll be forgiven. Why? Because you do deserve it. You once did that. It's all merit and admit it. If you once you prepared to forgo something that wasn't deserved, so you have on your credit, that particular energy. And therefore, you deserve that because that's who you are. So it'll be done for you. It's not the first-rate, full-hearted beginning of the mitzvah, but it's good enough to get one motivated. Start with the inner vested interest and use that thing. What do you do to somebody who is not willing to forgive, or you predict that they will not forgive you? Ask them without telling them what you did. There are weighty, broad halachic shoulders that sanction this, and you can do it. How do you do it? And I'll finish with this. There's a wrong way and a right way. The wrong way is to walk up to the individual and say, "You don't know what I did to you, but would you forgive me?" That is not the way to go about it. One's imagination then tends to run wild, and you definitely won't be forgiven. What you do is you walk up to the person and you say, "How are you doing?" And then you say, "You know, Yom Kippur coming up soon." And then you say to them, "You know, I heard this very interesting talk the other night where I learned that there's a very interesting Jewish custom. Did you know that before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we all, in families and friends, we all forgive each other for anything that may have happened in our relationship? Isn't that amazing?" And then if, you know, there's a resounding silence, you say, "So I just came to tell you that I forgive you for anything that you ever may have done. Don't worry about it and forget about it." And then you say, "And by the way, in case there's any, you know, in our relationship, right, relationships like ours, who knows, maybe something happened somewhere where I behaved in a way that was not quite perfect. And therefore, if that possibly did happen somewhere in the past, would you mind just saying that you forgive me for anything that ever happened?" And if they say, "Sure," it's over and forgiven. If they mean it, then you have achieved it. If they're mumbling some ancient formula that has no inner meaning, that does not achieve it. But if it is a meant thing, even a person so petty that they wouldn't forgive you if they knew what it was, because of their small-minded pettiness when offended by the issue, can be large enough to forgive when not faced by their own pettiness, that could be done. And therefore, that is it. Let me finish. If there's any question on specifics that we dealt with that I've omitted to explain clearly, if not, I'll be very happy to remain for those who need to.